Jesus teaching parables. Matthew 13, 11 through 17. He gives them the parable of the sower. And then the disciples, verse 10, come to him and say to him, "Why do you speak to them in parables?" He answered and said to them, "To you it has been granted to know the mysteries of the kingdom of heaven, but to them it has not been granted. For whoever has, to him shall more be given, he shall have an abundance. Whoever does not have, even what he has shall be taken away from him." Now, let me say here that those who believe in the dispensational approach to prophecy, Scofield and others, said that, they interpret that this way, that Jesus came announcing the Jewish messianic kingdom. The Jews did not cooperate. Therefore, at this point, he changed his mind. He decided not to set up the kingdom. He decided to go to a plan B, which is the church. So he, from this point on, he planned to establish the church, which was not in the prophets, and is not the kingdom. And so, in order to make the message of the kingdom a secret message to a few, as opposed to the general message to all the Jews, since he had changed his mind, then he began to teach in parables, talking about the millennial kingdom in these parables, because he had changed, he decided not to set up the kingdom at this time. I guess he decided to die on the cross and establish the church, and then he set the kingdom up at another time. And the parenthesis begins here. You heard about the parenthesis theory in eschatology? You understand what I mean by the parenthesis? When you took eschatology? Well, the parenthesis begins right here. Well, is that what he said? Isn't what he said, of course. So he who has much, what he has, he'll have more. He who has little should be taken away, even what he has. What does that mean? Well, let's see what he means. "Therefore, I speak to them in parables. Because while seeing, they do not see, and while hearing, they do not hear, nor do they understand. And in their case, the prophecy of Isaiah is being fulfilled, which says, 'You will keep on hearing, but you will not understand.'" We've already talked about this in dealing with sarcasm, irony, I mean. "You will keep on hearing, you will not understand. You will keep on seeing, you will not perceive. For the heart of this people has become dull, and with their ears they scarcely hear. And they have closed their eyes, lest they should see with their eyes, and hear with their ears, and understand with their heart, and turn again, and I should heal them. But blessed are your eyes, because they see, and your ears, because they hear. For truly I say to you, that many prophets and righteous men desired to see what you see, and did not see it, to hear what you hear, and did not hear it." What's he saying? Well, as I understand it, it is to identify those who were willing to learn, to judge those who were unwilling to learn. Why speak in parables? Why not just speak in straight, what we would call narrative prose? Just give it to them straight. Why give it in figurative language, they're asking? Why are you teaching in figurative language as opposed to just saying it? Well, Jesus says, I understand him, he had been saying it. "Repent, for the kingdom of God is at hand." And they said, "No, it isn't. What you're preaching is not what we expect the kingdom to be." And so the parables were designed to teach those who were willing to be taught and to judge those who were not willing to be taught. See? Judgment. What he has shall be taken away. But literally, the one who will not learn, the one who will learn, he shall receive more, and the parables will give him more. That is, you see, the issue is, the fact is, the situation is, that the majority of the Jews were not willing to take Jesus for what he said when he spoke in straight, non-figurative language. And so he began to teach in parables. Now the parables are very simple, aren't they? Are parables easier or harder to understand than the straight language? Well, in some cases they're easier. Well, you get the picture easier. But the point is that he's not saying that the elect, for instance, can understand the kingdom and the non-elect can't. He's simply saying that the majority of the Jews of that generation were not willing to listen, and therefore he was going to teach in parables, because this would give them the excuse they wanted to misunderstand. If he spoke to them just straight, he'd been doing that for some time, and they were rejecting it. Notice, they were not rejecting it. They were not rejecting it because they could not understand it. They were rejecting it because they did understand it. They just didn't like what they heard. They would not accept it. You see that? They would not accept it. And so, by teaching in parables, he gave those who did not want to accept it an excuse for not accepting it. Well, he's just telling stories. It's all in figurative language. And therefore, you see, what they did have would be taken away in that sense. And those who wanted, who were accepting the message of the kingdom, who were willing to listen to him, the parables would be a richer, fuller, more graphic teaching on the kingdom of God. You see that? So it is a judgment on those who were not willing to learn and obey. It would identify those who were willing. You see, it's like this. In other words, if God does this, remember, you have this principle. He cites the Old Testament, where in Isaiah's day, where if you say no to God, this is quite a principle, of course. We've talked about it before, perhaps, that if a person will not hear, they understand what God says, but they are simply not going to obey it. They're not going to respond. God gives them, he hardens their heart as he did Pharaoh's heart. He gives them over to a reprobate mind, as Paul words it in Romans chapter 1. What does that mean? God gave them over to a reprobate mind. What does it mean in Thessalonians that God sent them a strong delusion that they should believe a lie? I think it's the same thing that Jesus is saying in his teaching in parables. That if somebody understands very, for instance, in the days of Isaiah, did they understand what Isaiah was saying? Oh, yes, very clearly. Were they going to respond to Isaiah? Absolutely not. So God has Isaiah tell them, don't listen, don't respond, irony, giving them an excuse to turn him off, reject him. Well, I'm that crazy fella, so he's telling us not to obey him now. For all these years he's been trying to get us to repent, now he says don't repent. Well, crazy old fellow, I wasn't going to repent anyway. Like the reprobate mind, it gets so far into evil that it cannot tell the difference between good and evil. Why? Because God will send a strong delusion to believe a lie. That if we reject the truth, God will judge us in that he will give us plenty of better and more excuses to reject the truth. If you're going to do it right. It's a very serious thing to say no to God. It's a very serious thing to reject what we clearly understand. And this generation of Jews were rejecting what they clearly understood. So, is this making sense to you? So the parables gave them an excuse to reject it further. They were going to do it anyway. That is, if you don't, when I tell you about the kingdom in just straight literal language, you're not going to accept that. I'll tell you in figurative language. Give you and just to turn you off completely. And yet, those who would respond to what they understood, the parables were a further and better teaching. You see that? What one had was taken away, and one received more.
You see the act of hardening man's heart, basically a passive act on God's part.
No, I think it's active himself. Not now. It's active in the sense that he gives better opportunities. Like Pharaoh, he gave him more opportunities. He didn't do metaphysical surgery. He didn't telepathically alter his will. Didn't have to. Why? Pharaoh had already hardened his will against the word of God, had he not? He'd already hardened his own heart. He already freely decided. He'd rejected the evidence, the miracles. See, he'd already done it. God didn't have to do that. Jesus did not metaphysically, miraculously cloud their minds to the truth of the kingdom to turn them off to it. Didn't have to do that. They did that for themselves.
Well, okay, then when they're at that point, wouldn't if they continue, it's still a matter of their volition, is it not?
Really? Yes.
So, then why does he even have to say that God hardened their hearts?
Well,
it's their choice.
Yes, but he does it the same way that, as I understand it, Bars, good question. I think he hardened Pharaoh's heart the same way that the parables hardened the hearts of those who had already made up their minds they were not going to accept the message of the kingdom as Jesus preached it, for instance, in the Sermon on the Mount. They had already made up their minds, and so the parables were a further opportunity. In this sense, he hardened their heart in this way. Didn't have to change their will, or cloud their mind. They didn't have for themselves, what I'm saying. I say, why did he do it? Well, I think it's a judgment of God. You see, we think, am I answering your question? Are you asking why he did it?
No, I'm asking whether or not it's a passive act on God.
Well, I think it's an active act. It's not a miraculous act. See, it's not metaphysical. So he doesn't miraculously test their minds. He doesn't have to do that. But it's a positive act. It's positive in the sense that, for instance, Jesus switching to parables was a positive act, was it not? Something he positively did, which turned them off even further.
He's saying he gave them more opportunities.
Gave them more opportunities, a better opportunity to reject. You see, well, why does God do that? Well, as I understand it, it's a very, you see, we make a mistake if we think that we can say no to God with impunity. That we can, in other words, we think, and we often think this way, I can say no to God today. Why? Well, it's not so bad because I can always say yes to him tomorrow. And many people operate that way, and we operate that way in some area of our lives, don't we? You know, I know what God says, and I'm not doing it, but I'm going to. I'm saying no today, but I'll say yes tomorrow, or day after tomorrow, or when, as soon as I get soon as. So you can't treat God like that. You can't say to God, okay, I know what you want, but really I'm God in my life, and so you just wait till I'm ready. God says today is the day of salvation. Well, I say something different. I'll obey you, God, when I get good and ready to obey you. And you simply can't do that to God, because he's God and we're not. And I think God stops that by, as he said in Romans, giving people over to a reprobate mind. Not a miraculously changed mind. But you see, he gives the mind more opportunities, like in sending a delusion they should believe a lie, gives them more opportunities to harden their hearts so that later on they cannot change their minds back toward God. Why? Because, you see, the mind in and of itself does not have that quality. For instance, you cannot, that's one of the reasons I don't believe in deathbed repentance. I don't believe in it. Now, I wouldn't judge individual cases. Why? Because the human mind doesn't work that way. See, repentance is to turn the will and the heart toward God. So you can't do that in an hour. You can't live 65 or 70 years for yourself and then in 1 hour change your mind. You can get scared, but you cannot change your mind. Friends, you cannot reject God for 65 or 70 years and in one day start loving him. Follow me? You cannot make a conscious decision to love yourself, love your own way, love your own life, love your own kingdom, year after year after year, and then when you get scared, say, behold, I shall now love God. You cannot do it. The human mind doesn't work that way. And see, if you say, well, and by the very nature of the act, you see that? I'm off my subject now, but you see by the very nature of the act? For instance, if I say to God, now I know what you want me to do, and I have no intention of doing it because it doesn't fit in my plans, but I'm going to do it when I get good and ready. And I'll make this choice because I am God of my life, not you, at least in this area. But when the time comes, when I decide to get around to doing what God says, by the very nature of the act, when I say to God, okay, now I'm ready to do what you wanted me to do a long time ago, but I've got everything worked out and it now fits into my schedule for me to obey you in this area, in this one thing. Do you not see that I'm still being God? It's still my schedule? It doesn't become his simply because it happens to coincide with mine? By the very nature of the act, I have surrendered the possibility of ever really repenting, at least in that area of my life. this making sense to you? So the mind does become reprobate in that by the very nature of its own actions. You see, just because there are people walking around today, I wouldn't try to identify them. There are people walking around today who are just as lost as if they had been dead for 100 years and been in hell for 1,000. They may be 25 or 30 years old in perfect health, but they're just as lost as they'll ever be. Why? Because they have so hardened their hearts. They have consciously rejected God so systematically and so thoroughly and so deeply that their mind has gone beyond the point of no return. And the mind has within itself the mechanism by its very nature and push itself. Now, I would not presume to identify what that was in individual cases, but that's the principle of the reprobate mind, Romans 1.
Okay, go the other way then. Who's God?
It's a good question. I think it can. I think it's why we won't sin in heaven. He said, can I go the other way? And I said, I think it can.
Why would I come here?
That's why we won't sin in heaven. Well, theoretically, perhaps. You see, a person's... I think so, but I'm not saying sinlessness. I'm saying, I've met people like this who have loved God for so long and lived for Him so systematically that their mind is so fixed. The grooves are so deep, the habit patterns are so thoroughly established that it is, in my opinion, I'll say just an opinion, it's highly unlikely they would ever fall away from Him, if not impossible. Follow me? Not because of Calvinistic total depravity, but because the human mind works that way. It gets in grooves. You love something for so long, you just love it. And do you ever wonder why an old man, an old woman who are shriveled and ugly and decrepit can just love each other desperately? Ever seen old people really love each other, been married 50, 60 years? Just love each other desperately. When one dies, the other one dies. I guess, why? They've been loving him. They've been loving each other for so long. It's just the way their mind has worked. Their mind is in that groove. Their mind is set in that way. It's reverse. Whatever the opposite of reprobation is, that's what it is. Mind just set. They just love each other. But I think it's what the Bible talks about, being transformed from glory to glory. We talked about. Now I'm just giving you my opinion. Now my understanding of these texts, and you make up your own mind about it. Very interesting, though, isn't it? Well, interesting to think about. Now, let's get back to our topic. This is in this area that I understand. This is what I understand Jesus to be saying. That He judges early. The reprobate mind is a judgment, you see. He allows, it is a non-miraculous process. But the parables gave those who were not going to listen, who had made up their minds that they were not going to take His kingdom as He offered it, gave them further opportunity to reject Him. By switching from straight prose to figurative language, to parables. It also gave those who wanted to learn and were willing to respond deeper and better and richer teaching on the subject. Does that make sense to you? And that's why you make up, that's a very difficult text. But note this, it is a judgment, it is a blessing. Judgment on one, blessing on the other. I say to identify, you might put to identify and bless those, or however you want to word it. Based on again, to you it has been granted to know the mysteries of the kingdom, but to them it has not been granted. See, not by some mysterious unveiling or veiling of the mind, by the very nature of the thing. Well, you think about that. That's quite sobering, is it not? You come back to this one principle. It's very, very dangerous to say no to God on any issue, at any point in our lives. Because sometimes we kid ourselves saying, well, I can say yes later on. And that may not be true. Well, the purpose of parables. What are the rules for it? Any questions on this before I leave it? Well, you do your own thinking on the subject. What are rules for interpreting parables? First of all, the perspective principle. Parables must be interpreted with the understanding that Jesus was teaching about His messianic ministry and that Jesus was announcing the presence of the kingdom. That's what the parables were about. Look what He says. To you it has been granted to know the mysteries of what? The kingdom of heaven. That's the general content of the parables. There's the cultural principle. Parables must be interpreted in the light of their cultural background, that is, ancient Palestine. Now, I just put this in for the sake of completeness, because I've already talked about this. Bi-level interpretation, you interpret the parable itself and its historical content, then the analogical meaning. So I won't repeat that lecture. The exegetical principles. And again, we've already talked about these, and I put them here for the sake of completeness, and so I'm only going to read over those that we've already discussed. In most parables, the interpreter should seek to identify one central truth. In most parables, the interpreter must determine how Jesus himself interpreted the parable, if this information is available. And we've looked at that, have we not? The interpreter must identify available information from the context as it points to the meaning of the parable. And we've looked at that. Should we call Luke 15, 1 and 2, the three stories, lost son, lost sheep, lost boy? He told this to the scribes and Pharisees who were mad because he was joyfully accepting the Republicans and the Democrats, the publicans and the sinners. Okay, that's we've talked about. Next, the interpreter must consider Old Testament and intertestamental elements as points of reference. Old Testament and intertestamental elements as points of reference. Now, by that I mean some of the In the lower level of this bi-level interpretation, some of the content is determined by the Old Testament. For instance, and intertestamental elements. That is, I'm trying to think of an example. Well, that's not a parable. We talked about Enoch and Michael and Satan battling over the body of Moses. Well, by that I mean many of the customs that we see reflected in the parables are Old Testament customs, but many of them are intertestamental customs. Some of the things go back to the Old Testament, but some of them go back to only the intertestamental period. And so we need, in getting our true to history facts, understanding of the story itself, for instance, marriage, like it's like the synagogue in the New Testament, because it comes from the intertestamental period, not the Old Testament, and some of the customs, which, well, I don't have time to go into, but that's a basic principle. Yes.
Here you said intertestamental elements as points of reference, point as or order.
Should be as. Thank you. As points of reference. Okay. For instance, the marriage feasts, some of the elements of those were intertestamental, not Old Testament. You don't find all the rules in the Old Testament, or you don't find all these customs in the Old Testament. Okay, come to the doctrinal principle. We had the perspective principle, the cultural principle, exegetical principles. The doctrinal principle, the interpreter must not read. The interpreter must not read modern theological or eschatological systems into the parables. Now, this is very good. The interpreter must not read modern eschatological or theological systems into the parables. You cannot use the parables to defend Calvinism, or you can't use them to fight Calvinism, particularly. Now, modern eschatology, because the parables dealt with the kingdom, it is very dangerous to read modern eschatological systems into the parables, as is very often done. You might, that is, the parables will certainly inform eschatology, because they are generally about the kingdom or the fate of the Jewish nation. But they, you reason from the parables to the system, not the other way around, which is a very common error. Okay, and I've given some examples of that already. Let's come to page 27 to move right along. Rules for the interpretation of apocalyptic literature. What is apocalyptic? Yeah, Jeannie.
When we consider the parables as an allegory,
No, I dealt with that. A parable are allegorical, but they are not allegories. Where did I deal with this? Page 25, perhaps you were not here. Yes, they are. Some of them, yeah. Some parables, they are allegorical in character, and some, they function as allegories, like the parable of the sower, because you have points of reference at each all along. But that's the exception. Because it is the exception, what I say in here to help us keep that in mind, that depends on what you label it. It's a matter of choice how you label it. But to keep the distinctions in mind, because that's the exception, most parables just have one point. Then I make the statement to keep in our mind that the parables are not allegories. They're allegorical. And some even have the form of an allegory. But that's the exception. Okay, it's a good question. Now, rules. What is apocalyptic? Somebody tell me. Give me an example of apocalyptic literature.
Revelation.
Book of Revelation.
Daniel
contains apocalyptic sections. Yes. The Book of Revelation is. The Book of Thessalonians is not that. It's prophetic, but not apocalyptic. Parts of Ezekiel are apocalyptic, where you have a sustained vision or series of visions, clearly figurative and symbolic. This is apocalyptic literature. Of course, the Book of Revelation is a translation of Apocalypsis, the Revelation. And so here are some rules for interpreting this particular kind of apocalyptic, or of a figurative language. Number one, apocalyptic, by its very nature, does not permit a literalistic interpretation, even where the text, you'll get your money back on this one, even where the text may, at first glance, appear to make room for literalism. Got this. Okay, here's the rule. By its very nature, does not permit a literalistic interpretation, even where the text may, at first glance, appear to make room for literalism. Now, this is very important. Now, we talk about this in eschatology class, so it'll be a review for those of you who have had this course. But let me give you an example. I was attending a lectureship one time on the Book of Revelation by a man who was the dean of one of our Bible colleges, and I think would know better. And he went through the Book of Revelation. He basically took a version of the progressive historical approach. That is, he saw the Book of Revelation as unfolding all down through history. Each of the seven seals, different phase of history. And he went through very merrily anything in the Book of Revelation that conceivably, at first glance, could be literally understood. He understood it literally. And then when he was forced off that ground, he would interpret it or figuratively, symbolically. And so at the end of the lecture, and he constructed a very interesting system. Everybody was all goo-goo-ga-ga over what he was saying, and very interesting. When he finished, he asked for questions. He didn't know who I was, and I didn't tell him. I was just a preacher, ordinary, everyday preacher. I raised my hand and I said, it's actually been very interesting, and they were. I asked him, what hermeneutical principle have you followed in constructing your interpretation of the Book of Revelation? And he said, what do you mean? And I said, well, on what hermeneutical principle do you determine what's literal and what's figurative in the Book of Revelation? And so help me. He said, this fellow's the dean of one of our older, more well-established schools, so help me, this is what he said. And he's considered an expert in the Book of Revelation. He said, well, I just go through the Book of Revelation, and if it can be interpreted literally, I do so, and if it can't, I don't. I about fell out of the pew. Because you see, the Book of Revelation claims to be signs, spoken is symbolic by their nature. The fact that there are some elements in some of the symbols which could conceivably be isolated and interpreted literally does not mean that they should be interpreted literally, because they simply contribute to the overall symbolic character of the Book of Revelation. For instance, you know, if you have a horse. See, that's a literal animal. That's a literal horse. But you've got a beast, you know, like that with the imagery is borrowed from Daniel, with the body of one kind of an animal and the head of a lion with wings. then since no such animal exists, that's symbolic. You see that? Since there are real horses, that's literal. Since lions don't fly, that's figurative. That's how we know. That is so terrible. That is so bad. That's terrible hermeneutics. So the first rule is, by its very nature, it does not permit a literalistic interpretation, even where the text may at first glance appear to make room for literalism. I'll give you an example. For instance, Revelation 20, with one that just takes such a beating. You know, the dispensationalists and premillennialists, some of them, they go merrily through that chapter. They say, well, it's a 1,000-year reign upon earth. Why? It says 1,000 years, doesn't it? Is there such a thing as 1,000 years? Could that be understood literally? Yes, since there are thousands is a real number and years are real things. And we just take it for what it says. Well, therefore, what about the chain that binds Satan? Is that literal? Well, no, that's symbolic, you know. That's you know, because you can't bind Satan with a chain. He's a spiritual being, and a chain just wouldn't do it. That's figurative. Why is it figurative? Because it won't work literally, therefore it's figurative. You get the point? And by the way, Hal Lindsey and his whole tribe and all dispensationalists, that's exactly how they handle the book of Revelation. They simply go through it and they say, oh, we take the Bible for what it says, so if it conceivably can be literal, it is literal, only when they're forced, but, you know, I picture them on these Bible verses with their sword, you had to fight them. They defend their literalism to the very end, and when the very nature of the language forces them off the ramparts, then they surrender and reluctantly admit, well, this is figurative. Well, you know, it's like anything figurative, it's like a white flag. Well, okay, I give up, I surrender, okay, I admit this is figurative. I hate to admit it, but it is. Well, no, you see. The very nature of the book, for instance, of Revelation, is symbolic. And is to be understood as such. Let me give you an example of this, by the way. Let me ask you this. Of course, you know what the mark of the beast is, don't you? I talked to somebody one time. Well, it says the Revelation 13:16. Are you with me now? And he causes all, the small and the great and the rich and the poor and the free men and the slaves, to be given a mark on their right hand, on their forehead. Now, does this mean a literal, is there such thing as a forehead in the back of the hand? Right. Mark on their right hand. Therefore, it's literal. That means a literal mark. And I just received some literature through the mail today explaining, you know, more about the mark of the beast, 666 and all this stuff. Let me ask you this. Do you believe we're going to go in heaven, we're going to spend eternity with the name of Yahweh emblazoned on our forehead? Do you? Have you ever heard anybody believe that? We're going to go through eternity in heaven, for all eternity, we're going to have the name of Yahweh emblazoned on our forehead in indelible ink. You can see it with the ultraviolet light or whatever, and on our hands. Do you believe that? Have you ever heard anybody that preaches that? Have you? Anybody suggest that? You never heard that before, have you? I have never heard anybody suggest that. Carrie, you have? Who are you even listening to? Well, at least he's consistent. Look at Revelation 22:4. Revelation 22:4. Start with Revelation 22:1. Show me a river of water of life, clear as crystal, coming down from the throne of God and of the Lamb, in the middle of the street. On either side of that river was the tree of life, bearing 12 kinds of fruit, yielding its fruit, and so forth. No longer any curse, verse 3. The throne of God and the Lamb shall be in it, and his bondservant shall serve him, and they shall see his face, and what? His name shall be on their foreheads. I rest my case. My question is, you know what the question is? If Revelation 13 has to be taken literally, it says the mark of the beast will be on there as a literal mark on a literal forehead, then why is it not literal in Revelation 22? when God does it. Well, no, that's the, they don't. That's one or the other. You've been reading your books. Did you get my point? Have you ever read any of these guys saying, well, you know, we're going to go through eternity with the mark of God on our forehead? No, you see. Let me tell you something. The imagery means the same thing in both places. Some people are going to belong to God. Some people belong to, in the context of the book of Revelation, some people are going to be identified with Roman state religion, and they're going to have the mark of the beast, and then they're going to say, this is where I stand. I belong to the state. The mark on the forehead and the hand, slaves receive this. It was symbolic language indicating ownership. Who do you give yourself to? Let them own you. The question was, you're going to be the Roman state or God. And those who are going to be on the outside looking in are those who bowed down to Roman pagan state religion and rejected Christ, and those are going to be in eternity with God. As his children are going to have the mark of God on the forehead, which symbolically means what? They, in this apocalyptic literature, they said, I don't belong to Caesar as Lord, I belong to God, I belong to Jesus as Lord. This is all it means. But why is one, you see, either they're both literal, or neither one of them's literal. But I've never read, even the most avid, Carey, he reads a lot of more wildcat fundamentalist eschatological literature than I do, and I've read through a lot of books. I have never even seen the wildest eye dispensationalist suggest that the people of God, that's a literal mark. You get the point? Well, you see, it's a very selective hermeneutic to say, well, this is literal and that's not. It's a literal mark because it says a literal mark, and you can get whole books on the subject. Absolute stupidity, in my opinion. And it violates this very simple rule. Apocalyptic literature, by its nature, does not permit a literalistic interpretation. That's what it is. It's never offered as that. Even if, at first glance, certain elements within it could conceivably be interpreted literally as the mark of the beast. Is it conceivable that it could, that somebody could, you know, stamp the numbers on your forehead? By the way, you know, some of the ancient texts didn't even read 666. Some of them read 668. I think it was 660, 616, yeah. There's not even good textual evidence that that's the right number. Anyway, well, there's good textual evidence. It probably is, but you can't be sure. Yeah, 616. Okay, any questions on that? That's the first rule for interpreting apocalyptic. By the way, that rule, if that rule were followed, that rule automatically makes illegitimate 99 out of every 100 books written on the subject, on the book of Revelation and the book of Daniel. You go to the Bible bookstore or the library, you take all the books written on Revelation and Daniel, and you apply, if you say, we're going to burn all the books or throw them out that don't follow this rule of hermeneutics, you wouldn't have enough left to press flowers in. You'd give it almost all of them. Well, the next one, interpreter, what? The interpreter must determine, if possible, I say if possible because sometimes we don't know, there's no information available. The interpreter must determine, if possible, the significance of the symbols in the culture of the writer. Figurative language is heavily, listen to me, we've got much time, I'll start on this and we'll not finish this discussion today, but let me point out what again, this is a repetition for those who are in eschatology, but figurative language, of all kinds of language, is the most culturally conditioned. You have to have some insight into the culture sometimes to appreciate the figure, because even with generations, figures change. Like, it's like slang. You know, figurative. For instance, somebody says, hey man, that's cool. You don't say that anymore. Now when I was growing up, you know, we said, man, he's cool. But it's not cool to say cool anymore. For a while, you went from cool to bad. Talk about that, you know, he's cool, he's bad. What is it now? You said, what do you use, cool? Anybody know? Or it was when you were in high school.
Nothing? Your language is...
No, we did say nothing.
Oh.
Sharp.
Sharp? Yeah.
It's all right.
Yeah. Well, you see, and by the way, slang is figurative language, changes every 10 years, every few years. The symbols change. Now, it is very, that we simply start with the question, what did this symbols mean to them in their culture? By the way, I shared this with you before in eschatology class, and I shared this with Dr. Henderson. The number of the beast is 666. And I pointed out that when Nero killed I found this source in Suetonius. When Nero killed his mother to the Romans, killing a parent was an exception. Was about the worst thing you could do. It was worse than homosexuality. Worse than anything else was killing your parents. And Nero had killed his mother, who deserved it. But remember, at night, the Romans would write graffiti on the walls, condemning Nero at night. You know, sure wouldn't do it in the day. So every morning when they came out, here's this new graffiti jokes on the walls making fun of Nero. It was a very dangerous thing to do. And one of them, Suetonius says, one of them that made the rounds in Rome was, that somebody wrote, if you add the number of Nero's name, it equals kills your mother. What'd that mean? The number of his name equals, if you add them up, it equals the numbers for kill your mother, he killed his mother. What does that mean? Of course, we know what it means, don't we? That the numbers had numerical value, so if you added up Nero's name, it equaled the letters to make up the words, he killed his mother. And that's how they operated in those days, you see. The number of the 666, for instance, to say that today it's three Arabic sixes, is, of course, foolishness. When it says his number is 666, does it mean it would be three Arabic sixes in the 20th century? No. What does it mean? If you add up whoever the beast is, if you add up his name, the letters of his name, it'll come up to 616, depending on which text you use. 666. That's an example. If you go back and see what it meant in their day, I'll give you some more examples as we go. Literature, and the thing we were saying yesterday was that. We need the interpreter must determine, if possible, the significance of the symbols in the culture of the writer. This is another way of saying what we've said before, and that is this is a specific example of the principle that we ask, first of all, the question, what did it mean to them when it was written, not what it means to us. And I was using the example of the mark of the beast, the number of the beast is 666, and the thing of the number on the forehead and on the hand, that this was clearly symbolic of ownership or lordship, like a slave would have the name on the head, and that very few. Cary Nutting, I remember one preacher who said, "Well, God, you know, interpreted in Revelation 22 that God would put the name on the forehead," but it's clearly symbolic, and they would never have understood it that way. And to think of it in terms of what I'm saying is this: to look at the symbolism of Revelation 13. The mark of the beast, and to see a computer in it is exceeding strange. Yes. Yes, the mark, certain ones. Well, this kind of language was understood, was never understood literally, never understood that way, and by them, and so as I say, I said enough about that. Let's go on to the next one. The text must be examined to see if the meaning of the symbol or symbols is indicated in the passage itself. Give an example, Revelation 1:20, for instance. We have help in the text itself. As for the mystery of the seven stars, which you saw in my right hand, and the seven golden lampstands, the seven stars are what? The angels, the seven churches, and the seven lampstands are the seven churches. So if you're interpreting further up in the chapter, that which Jesus held in his hand, the seven stars and the seven lampstands, you don't have to go any further than the text itself to know what they mean, what they symbolize, right? Because he interprets it for us. Doesn't always do it, but sometimes that information is available.
We can be sure that
well, unless John mixed it, unless John missed it, yes. What's your question?
Well, I mean, like, it's all the way through.
Yes.
Then this here is literal.
Yeah, that's a little. That he said that's an interpret. That's parenthetical. Or it's in the, well, in the sense that it's an explanation of the. Of the he says you're wondering what these represent. I'm going to tell you what they represent. Not, that doesn't mean that every word. That's a good question, good point, Bart. When we say that apocalyptic literature does not permit a literalistic interpretation, we're not saying every word in an apocalyptic document, for instance, but only the symbols. Someone says John's on the Isle of Patmos, that's not apocalyptic, that's literal. You know, and the Lord's Day was literally the Lord's Day. But when it gets into the visions, substance of the visions, then they are by definition symbolic. Fourth principle is this: ancient history must be consulted to determine the possible fulfillment of the apocalyptic prediction. That is, especially take the book of Daniel. One of the common mistakes made in the book of Daniel is that many modern interpreters of Daniel are so anxious to use Daniel as a springboard to get into our future and to modern times that they pay no attention whatever, or give little attention to the possibility that much of what Daniel had talked about was already fulfilled. I'll give you a couple of examples. First of all, those who take a parenthesis view of the church, as you know, and speak of the revived Roman Empire, we discussed this in eschatology class, very quick to look to the future. But look at flip back to Daniel 11, and I'm not going to do a study of Daniel 11, but to sort of give you some guidelines for future study, and we do study this in the course on Daniel. The modern interest today in the Middle East, I got a document through the mail yesterday offering something of a prophecy hotline to a prophecy update. You know, they looked at what's going on in the Middle East now and with the president of Egypt and his discussions and how this fits in with prophecy, to update it. Well, all of that business about looking to Egypt and the negotiations comes from a misunderstanding of Daniel 11. He will gain control, verse 43, over the hidden treasures of gold and silver, over all the precious things of Egypt, and Libyans, the Ethiopians will follow at his heels. This coming figure, but rumors from the east and the north will disturb him. He will go forth with great wrath to destroy and annihilate many. But that whole section, and this is my point here, that whole last section of Daniel 11, last part of Daniel 11, which is supposed to be a prophetic description of what goes on in the Middle East in the last days, as I understand the book of Daniel, and looking into history, which is the principle we're looking at, has already been fulfilled. I think it's very clear what he's talking about, because there is no break in it. He's talking about the what's called the Actian War. He goes from Antiochus Epiphanes, verses 31 and 32, and down to verse 35, the Hasmoneans. And then it says in verse 36, then the king will do as he pleases, he will exalt and magnify himself. And if you go along in history, the next major king, you would say, the next major figure is Herod the Great. And there's no evidence in the book of Daniel there's a break of 2,000 years, sort of taking things progressively. And if you look at Daniel 11, 36 through 45, to the end of that chapter, that is a good prophetic description of Herod the Great, the Actian War, and Augustus' invasion of that part of the world, and fits very well. Now, my point is that ancient history must be consulted to determine the possible fulfillment of the apocalyptic predictions. Now, By the way, that would sure put a lot of books out of print if they would simply do that. But you can think about that and study it in the future. And I say we study it in the Book of Daniel, or an elective course, class on Daniel. Do you have any questions on this principle? What I'm saying is there is no justification, but there's a twofold lack of justification for looking at Daniel 11, 36 through 45 as being descriptive of modern events in the Middle East. Number one is there's the contextual lack of justification. There's no indication in the text there's a 2,000-year break, or actually more than that. Is there? It seems to move right along progressively. Secondly, when you have events in ancient history which fulfill this very well, just like you have Antiochus Epiphanes fulfills sections of Daniel very well, and the Maccabean revolt fulfills it very well, why not just look ahead to the next major phase of history and look at Herod the Great and the Actian War, because it fits it very well. There's no justification for looking at modern nations. Yes.
It's not true that the language in Daniel appears signs.
Yes. Now this part of Daniel is not apocalyptic. It's just straight prose. This is going, whereas in the first, in the symbols and like the image, and the beast, the ten horned beast, and the other, that is apocalyptic. That's part of Daniel. But this last part of Daniel is not. It is prophecy, but it is not apocalyptic.
Then why was it included in Daniel?
Hmm. Well, that's a good question. because I include that because Daniel. Those who make this mistake always tie it in with the apocalyptic sections in Daniel. They're always diagrammed together, as it were. Well, you could find examples in straight apocalyptic, not just prophecy, but straight apocalyptic, in the book of Revelation. As a matter of fact, I think that is a fundamental mistake made in the whole book of Revelation very often. That is, are the events symbolically depicted, apocalyptically predicted in the book of Revelation, are they generally fulfilled in the early generation or generations of the church? The answer is, I think, yes. And therefore, there you would have a straight apocalyptic with the principle would apply. Yes. You mean a particular book? Well, it can. There's nothing about apocalyptic language itself, if this is what you're asking, which says it cannot be, say, historic, fulfilled in a historic, progressive way. For instance, much of Daniel is. It takes up through the time of Babylon, and then Persia, and then Alexander the Great, you see, up to the top to the Messiah. It does. So But that doesn't mean it has to. It depends on the nature of what the symbols represent.
So if we had an interpretation that fit it, we all at once put like a master course, mm-hmm. We have no reason to say it's still
there. Right. And again, say the difference in Daniel and Revelation. See, often those who interpret Revelation, historically, progressively, they say, well, sections of Daniel are work that way. That's very true. Except that there's a difference. You look at clues within the book itself. For instance, and we study this in Daniel class, Daniel is told, don't close the book for the time is not, I'm going to close the book for the time is not yet. You're going to see these things down through the years. But John is told just the opposite at the end of the book of Revelation. Don't close the book because time is now. These things are short. For instance, the book of Revelation is about those things. These things are, listen to this, Revelation 1:3. Blessed is he who reads and those who hear the words of the prophecy and heed the things which are written in it, for the time is what? Near. See. And at the end of the book of Revelation, it is like bookends of the book of Revelation, which gives what I'm saying is, listen to Revelation 22:10. Said to me, do not seal up the words of the prophecy of this book, what? For the time is near. Well, that's a pretty clear indication, isn't it? That is an indication, not the only indication, of a time frame, a general time frame for in which we should look to see the fulfillment of the book itself. And it would fit with this principle. And do we find this in history, you see? Do we find the kind of struggle that we read about in the book of Revelation? The answer is, in my opinion, yes, we do. So when these things accumulate, you got the sign, the hints in the book itself, then you find this kind of fulfillment, then there's no justification for looking elsewhere. Okay. Did I answer your question, Jane? Last of all, in the interpretation of the New Testament apocalyptic, consideration must be given to the use of the symbols in the Old Testament if they appear in the Old Testament. Now, one of the, and I'll just, again, be very general about this because time is getting away from us. Do we find some of the symbols are the same kinds of symbols, same kinds of imagery is the word I want, in the book of Daniel, for instance, that we find in the Old Testament? The book of Revelation that we find in Daniel. Answer is yes. Find the same, sometimes the very same images. For instance, the appearance of Christ in the first chapter of Revelation is the same as this figure which appears to Daniel. Daniel about, I think, chapter 7. Same figure. You know, hair white, you know, and the blazing eyes and the voice like thunder. His feet is burnished brass. Same figure. In Revelation, in the book of Revelation, we find, for instance, animals, beasts, which are either the same or which are similar to what we find in the book of Daniel. Now, what does that tell us? Let me ask you this. If you find, say, an animal or a symbol or an image in the book of Revelation that is either the same or very similar to what you say find in the book of Daniel, for example, does it mean they're talking about the same thing? What do you say? The answer is not necessarily. It may be. For instance, where you have the Christ figure appearing, a symbolic presentation of Christ or appearance of Christ, I think it's talking about the same thing. But not necessarily. It does suggest, and listen to me, it does suggest, however, that they're talking about the same kind of thing. And I think that is very clear. But maybe not the same particular thing, but the same kind of thing. For instance, persecuting monarchs. Got that? Pagan kings, pagan dynasties who persecute the people of God, right? Represented by fierce animals. So that's the same kind of thing, but it does not necessarily mean it's the same king and the people of God are the same. For instance, you have them, you know, in the Revelation 20, the camp of the saints. Well, who is it? Old Testament saints or New Testament saints, you see? Is it the Jews? Is it Jerusalem? Or is it the spiritual Jerusalem and the spiritual people of God, spiritual Israel? Same kind of thing, but not the same particular thing necessarily. Y'all see that? It's a very important distinction. And as a matter of fact, there are very few, listen to me, you often hear people say this. Well, you know, you must study the book of Daniel and the book of Revelation together because they're about on, you know, the same topic. And you often, people just sort of generally do that, don't they? Daniel and Revelation go together. As a matter of fact, Daniel and Revelation have very little to do with each other, in my understanding of both. They cross paths in their subject matter very little. So is what they're talking about. What you do find, and this is what leads people to say this, you do find very often the same kinds of imagery. But just because you find the same kinds of, or the same imagery, doesn't mean that the fulfillment of that is the same. All it means is they're talking about the same kind of thing. And, for instance, when I teach the book of Daniel, I get in the book of Revelation very little, if any. Why? I find no reason to. And when we go to the book of Revelation, and we're looking at an image, we want to say, now, what kind of thing is it talking about? Then we go back to the book of Daniel and say, well, if it talked about, they represented that in the book of Daniel, then we look for the same kind of thing in the book of Revelation. Y'all see the difference there? It's a very important distinction. There's where a cross-reference might get you into trouble if you drew unfounded conclusions from it. Okay, any questions on that? I'm finished with. All right. I'd like to talk about it more, but time is getting away from us. Okay. Just as in the case of what we've already studied, when we get to the rules of the interpretation of prophecy, we're going just to be repeating ourselves a little bit, as I told you we would, so some of this I'll just mention and move on. Particular rules for the interpretation of prophecy. Number one, the form and meaning of a prediction must be studied in the light of the situation of the prophet. The situation of the prophet. The form and meaning of a prediction. Now let me read this statement, and I'm going to explain a little bit. The work of a prophet is so intimately connected with the needs and conditions of his people, and condition of his people, that his prediction as well as his instructions must be studied in their historical setting. It must not be assumed that a prophet's message is designed wholly for future generations. They were intended to encourage or restrain the people of his own age. If you want to prove this to yourself, here's a good study, and we have time to do it with you. But just take a list of all the prophecies of the first coming of Christ. Okay? Prophecy of the coming of the Messiah into the world. Just go through Matthew, like the Emmanuel prophecy, different prophecies of the first coming of Christ. And you go back and read them in their original statement. Go back to the Old Testament and read them. And you will see in their context that they served a purpose to encourage or restrain or instruct or warn the people of their own generation. Now, often, for instance, some of the messianic prophecies are saying, they're in this kind of context, that we are under the judgment of God because we have turned against God, we have rejected the one who loved us, and he is going to allow us to suffer for our own good. But he's going to bring us back into the land, and then he's going to do something that's very, very something that you've never thought, could never have thought of. And then you have the messianic prophecy within this kind of context. You got that with the promise of the coming of the Messiah. Very often, is sort of, it's a part of a general a teaching of warning and or encouragement to their own generation. That is, you do not listen to me. Let me lay it on you this way. Do not, when you look at Isaiah and Jeremiah and Ezekiel and Zechariah, even when they are giving messianic prophecies, do not see the Old Testament sanctified version of a gypsy with a crystal ball who sees the future and nothing else. The futuristic element in the Old Testament prophecies, even the messianic prophecies, is often in their original context an incidental element. I said again, the future aspects, even in the messianic prophecy, which are specifically eschatological from the Old Testament point of view, when you read them in their original statement, often that element is, in its total context, of the ministry of the prophet, even that particular message of the prophet, is often incidental. Can you buy that? Well, you study the subject and you'll see that this is true. Now, what I'm saying, which ought to make us very careful about treating the prophecies as if their primary emphasis is eschatological from their point of view, future. As I already made the statement that many of the prophecies that are cited by the New Testament apostles and prophets and Jesus himself, we would never know were prophecies of the Messiah and the kingdom if we weren't told. Now some of them we would. Some are very clear. The wise men saying, where is he born king of the Jews? They knew. Why? The prophets are very clear about that. In Bethlehem, city of David. But others, many of them, are just not that clear. And sometimes, they are fulfilled in the sense of being analogous or illustrative, not predictive. Remember, I talk about the Nazarene. He shall be called a Nazarene, born in Nazareth. That is analogical and illustrative in content, not predictive. So that In other words, if you're going to study, appreciate Old Testament prophecy, you study them originally in their own context, and then we can appreciate their futuristic element. For instance, I'll give you some of these examples. The Protoevangelium, Genesis 3:15. I'll put enmity between thee and the woman, between thy seed and her seed. He shall bruise thy head, now shall he shall bruise thy heel. He shall bruise thy head, now shall bruise his heel. Of course, that looks to the future. In the first preaching of the gospel, the Protoevangelium. But did it not serve to warn, restrain, and perhaps encourage Adam and Eve? I think so. That God saying, we've got trouble now because of your sin, but it is not hopeless. Isn't that an encouragement? Noah's prophecy, Genesis 9, I'm not going to take time to read it. This is after his sons had humiliated him. Talks about that Canaan would serve the others, serve Shem, the descendants of Shem. And, of course, I look down to the time when Canaan was occupied by the children of Israel, and they became hewers of wood and carriers of water. And the sons of Ham, Cain, served the sons of Shem. But did it not serve to sort of set things right? But was it not a rebuke, for instance, to the sons of Noah themselves to restrain and warn them? I think so. And of course, even Isaiah 9, 6 through 7, you can read this later. I wish I had time to go into it with you. I make this statement here, a glorious messianic prophecy framed in the language which contrasts the beauty of the future king with the shame of Ahaz of Judah and the ugly arrogance of the king of Assyria. But that certainly was instructive, and it was a rebuke. It was a warning to that generation and the leaders of that generation. So that's the first principle. The form and meaning of a prediction is to be studied in the light of the situation of the prophet. And by the way, this is the reason why the prophecies, while they are very clear, some of them are, even the clear ones are not, the prophecies being clear are not, in their original context, always precise. Prophecies are just not that way, not very precise. The exception being some of the prophecies in the book of Daniel, and some in Ezekiel, some in Zechariah, and a few in Isaiah, where, you know, where Cyrus is named. That's pretty precise, isn't it? Sometimes they are, but often they are not precise. Okay. Next, any questions on that? Okay, a prophecy must be interpreted in harmony with its fulfillment if that be known. Got that? A prophecy interpreted in harmony with its fulfillment if, as a matter of fact, the fulfillment is known. Now, let me give an example here. 2 Samuel 7, 12 through 16. This is we've looked at this before. This sounds familiar to me. 2 Samuel 7. This is, by the way, this is a key, remember the sure mercies of David? Did I discuss that with you, the sure mercies of David prophecies? I discussed that somewhere recently. Did I discuss that in here? Soteriology, perhaps. Let's look at 2 Samuel 7, 12 through 16. When you're, David is speaking, or God is speaking through the prophet to David, but by the way, this became such a well-known prophecy and promise to the nation of Israel that it came to be called the sure mercies of David. Do you know why? Did I tell you, did I talk about that? I haven't. Anyway, remember God tells David he's not going to let him complete the house, the temple that he has planned. His son was going to do that. Why? Because David was a man with bloody hands. But he says, when your days are complete and you lie down with your fathers, as when you're after you're dead and buried, I will raise up your descendants after you, who will come forth from you, and I will establish his kingdom, your descendant, I will establish his kingdom. And he shall build a house for my name,
and I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever. I'm not going to let you build a house. I am going to let him build a house. It will establish his kingdom will be forever. I will be a father to him. He will be a son to me. When he commits iniquity, I will correct him with the rod of men, the strokes of the sons of men. But my loving kindness, here's why it was called the sure mercies of David, the name of this promise, the rubric under which it was included. But my loving kindness shall not depart from him. It had from David. And by the way, it was going to from Saul. Remember, Saul made the same mistakes David made, the same kind of mistakes. As I took it away from Saul, whom I removed from before you. Note that Saul, David, and Solomon, each one fell into sin, did they not? And were condemned. Solomon, the ultimate, found the nation was divided after his death. But this one is not going to have that problem. I will not have to withdraw my mercies from him, as I did from Saul, he's telling David. Hence the sure mercies of God, that is, that God would not have to punish this king who was going to be a descendant of David. Now, was he talking about Solomon? The question I raised in the note, was he talking about Solomon? Well, I think it's clear that he wasn't. Doesn't fit Solomon. Solomon, he's told elsewhere that Solomon could do this. He isn't told it here. But look at Acts. And by the way, the question is, of course, dispensationalists and premillennialists look to this and say, well, the day is coming when God is going to set Jesus on the messianic throne in Jerusalem, and that'll be the kingdom. But look at Acts 2:29. And I think it is so significant that in the very first gospel sermon, which we call Peter's sermon, and I think correctly so, this is one of the prophecies he cites. Keep in mind, this was very big upon the minds of the Jews. By the way, you see this in the Mishnaic and the Talmudic literature. Like they developed whole theories about this Davidic promise, the sure mercies of David. They even developed a theory of two messiahs, a priestly messiah and a kingly messiah. Why? Because Isaiah had talked about suffering and death, and obviously that wasn't going to be the case with this one. How Peter understands this prophecy. Look at verse 29, Acts 2:29 and following. Brethren, I may confidently say to you regarding the patriarch David that he both died and was buried, and his tomb is with us today. It's like a strange point to make in a sermon, doesn't it? He says to the Jews, now I'm going to declare to you that David is dead, had been dead for some time. Oh, they know he was sick. That David was dead, he was buried, and he's still in the grave. I would have said, so what? Oh yeah, that's big news. Why is he making such a point of saying that David is dead and buried, and his grave is still with us? Because this key messianic prophecy, the sure mercies of David, had promised what? While you are in your tomb, you will die, and while you are in your grave, I will raise up one of your descendants to sit on your throne, and he will establish it forever. And so, because he was a prophet and knew that God had sworn to him with an oath to seat one of his descendants upon his throne, see, it's a direct reference to 2 Samuel 7, he looked ahead and spoke of what? Of the second coming of Jesus. Right? No, of what? The resurrection of Jesus. Verse 31. And he was neither abandoned to Hades, nor did his flesh suffer decay. That's Christ. God raised him up and put him where? On the throne. Verse 33. Exalted the right hand of God. Verse 34. For it was not David who ascended to heaven, but he himself says, the Lord said to my Lord, sit at my right hand till I make thine enemies a footstool for thy feet. Clear statement by Peter that Jesus has fulfilled that prophecy. And what was that prophecy about? The resurrection, exaltation, and enthronement of Jesus. Which sort of fits with the general picture that Jesus, that the church is the messianic kingdom. Note this, he didn't say one word about second coming, did he?
or he didn't push it to the future. That is a very key element, by the way. You see the kind of prophecy. This is why, by the way, dispensationalists have to say that the Old Testament interprets the New Testament, not the other way around. Because if you allow Peter's interpretation to stand, then you got a real problem. If you don't believe the church is the kingdom, see that? If you believe that he's talking about the second coming and the millennium, not a word about it. Now, what I'm saying is that a prophecy, this is an example, 2 Samuel 7, a prophecy, this prophecy must be interpreted in harmony with its fulfillment if that be known. They're not always known, are they? We don't have, notice, we don't have every particular messianic promise cited in the New Testament. But I'll say two things about this. Now listen very closely. We know what this prophecy means, don't we? We know of its fulfillment. Peter tells us. And Peter was inspired by the Holy Spirit. That settles the issue. But secondly, we also have a key or have help in understanding, now listen to me, understanding what this kind of prophecy meant. How this kind of prophecy should be understood. That is, does this not, in other prophecies which are cited, does this not give us a guideline, a hint, a clue for understanding how the messianic kingdom prophecies in general should be understood? If this key one, this foundational one, that David's throne, if that foundational prophecy, it was a key prophecy. And by, for instance, references are made to it. The sure mercies of David. Think of some other references off the top of my head in which other references are made to it under that title, The Sure Mercies of David. You can look it up in a concordance, but other references are made to The Sure Mercies of David. I outline them in my little book on Armstrongism, which shows that very clearly how the apostles understood that prophecy. Keyword is, if it be known. There's no justification for giving any other interpretation. Questions on that? Yes.
Did you just say something about verse
14? In Acts 2? Okay. Read it for me. I think he is talking about, again, you see, it's not very specific because we know Jesus did not sin, but I think he is indicating that he is going to suffer in the process of being crowned. There's suffering on the way to his being crowned. I think this is the same thing that Paul is talking about when that he learned obedience by suffering. That's the way, it's very difficult. That's the way I understand it, Gene. It's a tough verse, yes.
Could it also be like Romans 13:4, where the idea of government and then God sometimes uses that to bring wrath upon the world of Christ?
Yes, I think so. Well, let's try to get one more in today. See, no prophecy should be approached with an assumption of what it should contain. No prophecy should be approached with an assumption of what it should contain, as if we had written it. Give an example of Jeremiah 31:15 and Matthew 2:17-18. Let's look at the Matthew text first. Then that which was spoken through Jeremiah the prophet was fulfilled, saying, a voice was heard in Ramah, weeping in great mourning, Rachel weeping for her children, she refused to be comforted because they were no more. Now this
Matthew cites at the slaughter of the infants in and around Bethlehem by Herod the Great, of course. Let's look back at Jeremiah 31:15. And read the prophecy which he said this was fulfilled. Thus says the Lord, a voice heard in Ramah, lamentation and bitter weeping. Rachel is weeping for her children. She refused to be comforted for her children because they are no more. What is the context of this? What is the context? Well, historically, it is talking about the prospective deportation of many into Babylon. That is, the suffering of the judgmental suffering of Judah at the hands of the Babylonians, and that there's going to be weeping. The point I make here is the prophecy has a clear fulfillment in the grief of the captives gathered at Ramah, weeping over the fate of Jerusalem and over their own misery at the hands of the Babylonians. Now listen to this statement I'm going to make. I think here, remember I said we're going to repeat some of these things? Here we have a clear example of the same kind of, it was fulfilled in the same sense as I understand it, that Jesus being living in Nazareth fulfilled the prophecy he should be a Nazarene branch, that it was fulfilled in the sense that this is, we would word it, is a striking parallel. That's what Matthew is saying. It's fulfilled in that sense, and we've seen that Matthew, for instance, uses the term fulfilled, which is spoken by the prophet, in many ways, sometimes fulfilled in the sense of a specific prediction. Fulfilled, it sometimes means this is the same kind of thing that happened. You get that? We would say, for instance, something happens and it reminds us of something that happened before. I don't think that the prophecy, listen to me, I don't think that the prophecy in Jeremiah, now Doc Smith may disagree with this, but I'll tell you what I think, you make up your own mind. He may agree with it. I think when Jeremiah made this prophecy, that God, neither God nor Jeremiah, was pointing to the slaughter of the infants by Herod the Great. May have been. May have been. I don't know. In my understanding of this, what Matthew is saying is, and this is a common use of the language, we've seen that, he is saying, what happened here is parallel to, it reminds us of, it's the same kind of thing, it had the same result of what happened when our people suffered at the hands of the Babylonians. There was weeping in Ramah over lost children when the Babylonians were coming in. There was weeping in Ramah over lost children when the forces of Herod the Great swept through. Parallel situation. See that? Fulfilled in that sense. Now whether it was an intended connection, some say yes, some say no. I say not necessarily. And the rule is we don't approach the Jeremiah text with an assumption of what should be there. Yes. Ah, good point. You see, this is the very reason. I don't believe in a double fulfillment in that sense. Double fulfillment. In other words, I don't think Jeremiah's prophecy had a double fulfillment in the sense that both events were predicted. You see my point? Your question is excellent. Right? Your question is right to the point. You see, if Jeremiah's prophecy was a double fulfillment in the sense that Jeremiah was predicting both the suffering back in the 7th century, in 6th century B.C. talking about, you know, what's going to happen in 586. He was talking about that and talking about Herod the Great, slaughter of the infants. Then you have a genuine double prediction, double prophecy, double fulfillment. I do not think prophecy works that way. That's what I'm saying. I don't think Jeremiah had that in mind.
I think when Matthew cites it in the same way he cites other prophecies, in the sense he is saying this fulfills that, in the sense that, not that it was predicted, but that it fulfills in the sense that this is a striking parallel. It's the same kind of thing. Now, by the way, this is idiomatic use, this is our language. I would point out that we have in our idiom exactly the same thing. Have you ever said this before? Okay? Something happens, you say, this has happened before. Literally? No. It's impossible. It's like, this has not happened before. It couldn't happen before because now is now, and then was then, and now is not then, and then is not now. See, this has happened before. You ever do something, you feel like, well, I've been here before. Or, it's all happening again. I thought I was done with that. Here it is happening again. No, you don't mean the same thing is happening again. What you mean is, what's happening now is a striking parallel to what happened then. And I think that language is used the same way. So we are not justified, Lisa, in saying, therefore, every prophecy has a double, or can have a double, is doubly predictive. If that's true, why not three? Why not triply predictive? If you're going to have two meanings, why not ten? Now, this is very sticky, and I say, Doc Smith and I don't agree on every point on this, and you should, I say, you get more than one point of view on this. It's very difficult. And I'm not sure I don't want to represent his position. Try to. We've had some discussion, but not at length. I don't really know his position on this. But I think it'd be interesting. You'd make up your own mind. But this is my understanding of it. Yes. Same kind of thing. Yes. Yeah, but not necessarily intended that way. In other words, now listen to me. Listen very closely. I am not saying that there is no inspired connection between the two. But there is an inspired, a divinely revealed connection between Jeremiah and Matthew on the point of weeping in Ramah. What I'm saying is the inspiration comes from Matthew's end of it, as I understand it. Got that? Matthew makes the inspired connection. I don't think Jeremiah was making an inspired connection. Now, sometimes the prophet does make an inspired connection to the future, obviously, some prophecies. Right? Some of them is very clear. But I think the inspiration comes from Matthew's point of view. See that? So we are justified in saying, yes, there's that prophetic connection, but Matthew makes it. Which is not true of all prophecies. Don't misunderstand that.